obscurity. We're early. Eric had a hot date. Not with his wife.
So we cut him loose.
Yeah, we let him go tend to that. Whatever it is, probably going bowling. If I'm honest, probably bowling. Thanks for hanging out with us tonight. This is Chasing Sound. You're streaming us live at koop.org, most likely. Also a possibility. You got an HD radio, and you're tuning us in on the KVRX HD3 signal. You might also be listening to us on a rebroadcast at Radio Free America. I have a little bit of a cold, so I apologize in advance if my voice is annoying or abnormal. I shall do my best. I ate like 20 cough drops before I got here to tighten up for y'all.
Let's do this.
We're going to do this freaking thing, this cussing thing. How was your week, sir?
It was good. Went to some South by shows.
What'd you see?
I saw the OCs. I saw Megafauna.
Oh, no way.
Who's been featured on the show.
Totally. How is Danny's arm doing?
Oh, yeah, she was totally better.
We need to freaking have Megafauna up in here. We had Danny in here with Joseph from Technicolor Hearts, but Danny had just busted her arm, so we had to have her freestyle vocally. And I wish I hadn't put her in that position, a dry mic with no reverb.
Like, yeah. Hey,
just freestyle while Joseph and I meander in this, you know, whatever we were doing, very mood, atmospheric music. So, yeah, we need to have that band on here. Before we all die in some fashion. So what story did you do on your show Friday?
I'm blanking.
Oh, well, it was probably a Dr. Seuss
thing.
But
it was great.
Yeah, I'm sure it was great, which is why you've blacked it out. It's probably a sci-fi situation where some alien put a chip in you, and now you can't remember what story you read.
Yeah, or I just got so lost in the characters. I think it's my own
memory. You got lost in it, yeah. Probably. Do you know what show you're going to do this Friday?
Yeah.
Or story?
It's called The Red Line, and it's told between like letters going back and forth between two characters.
Nice. I just got some new books in the mail. Speaking of sci-fi, I got a Philip K. Dick book. It's the story about a civilization that lives in underground bunkers while the politicians and upper class or whatever, the elites are up top enjoying all the resources and pretending that, like, World War is happening. So they send down all this news of, like, oh, death, destruction, but they're up there, like, sipping martinis. And Philip K. Dick spins it in this interesting way where you are sympathetic to the elites because they're doing such a good job of promoting this fake war. So, I don't know. It's fascinating. Typical Philip K. Dick, twist your mind around kind of stuff. So tonight, without further ado, this evening's episode of Chasing Sound is dedicated to the brief but meaningful musical movement known as industrial. If you missed it completely, I'm sorry. It was brief, though. So maybe 1987, 1988 through probably maybe 97. Those are the years where it was the most productive and the most specific to its style. I'm not going to say it's the most important movement in history, but it did have a couple of artists who legitimized it to the point where it was art. It was important. Not the least of which being Trent Reznor from Nine Inch Nails. There were some other important acts, some acts that didn't make it to tonight. I'm not going to play Skinny Puppy because while they influenced a lot of the industrial bands, they didn't really fit in my playlist tonight. I'm not going to play Front 242 or Knights of Reb. There's lots of classic industrial bands, but, you know, at some point I have to make a coherent playlist that fits together, and I went for some of the more brutal stuff tonight. Pulling out the big guns tonight. So, first I want to talk about Nine Inch Nails a little bit. So, Nine Inch Nails, they're coming up, and it's basically just Trent Reznor and all of his keyboards and his samples, and basically, it's the late 80s. At the time, keyboard music was considered kind of passé. Everybody was really getting into, you know, Marshall stacks with fuzz pedals, and just, it was like this 70s revival almost with this big, heavy guitar sound. And Trent Reznor was like, you know, so what? Like, I don't care if this stuff is going out of style. This is what I like. I like glitchy electronic stuff. I like sampling myself and then tweaking that sample into oblivion. And he was just finding his own sound. And he ended up getting signed by a record company called TVT, which was best known before Nine Inch Nails for being the record label that put out the theme song for Mr. Ed, the Talking Horse show. If you missed that on Nick at Night, it was a riot. You know, they put peanut butter on that horse's teeth to make it look like he's talking. So when you think of how much peanut butter that horse must have had and how gassy it must have been, that can't have been good for that horse. So this company, TVT, it's a typical rock and roll story, just like the record label that signed Creedence Clearwater Revival. They signed them for like an 80-album deal and just had them locked. And so Trent Reznor gets signed to this horrible deal, but at the time when you have nothing, you don't think about these things. You're just like, oh, a record deal. You never imagined that you would be so lucky. And then Pretty Hate Machine comes out, and it is a phenomenon. And he wants out of this record deal. But the TVT guy, there's one main guy that wouldn't let him go. And record labels were trying to figure out what to do. We're offering millions of dollars to buy him out of that contract, and no one was having any success. It would be like trying to get someone in the late 80s to give up having U2 under contract. Mm. This guy's like, no, I don't think so. I don't exactly have a lot of other artists in my stall that are going to make up this income that you're trying to take from me. So eventually this one genius guy who had worked with a ton of bands in the 70s and 80s, and he was linked up with Dr. Dre, and he was working on a label called Interscope. And this guy, and I say he's a genius, that's an understatement. He goes to TVT and says, let's just be partners. Like, I'll handle distribution. You know, we'll split everything, whatever, 50-50, and it'll be released by Interscope and TVT Records. So he makes a partnership, and he was the first guy after 100 different label heads had gone after this contract trying to buy Nine Inch Nails. He figured it out. He for a way for everybody to make money. And at this point, Trent Reznor, it had been years. Like, the everyone was anticipating a follow-up for this album, Pretty Hate Machine, which is, you know, come on, Head Like a Hole, Terrible Lie. There's some killer classic tracks on that. So finally, Interscope gets him, and Trent Reznor's like, surprise, I made this EP with my friend Flood. Of course, Flood would go on to be one of the most legendary producers of all time, but at the time, he was not that. And he's like, yeah, I made this EP. Can you put it out? And they're like, you know, it had been years. So they're like, of course, we'll put out anything you make. So he hands over this EP, and it sounds nothing like Pretty Hate Machine. It is skull-shattering brutality. It's like, take Ministry and amp it up on steroids, and that's what you've got. It just was so heavy. Not only did he want that release, but he wanted its sister album, Fixed, which was just his favorite club DJs remixing the stuff, making it even weirder and even more jagged. So they're like, okay. And they released this EP out into the world in 1992. And this is an important thing. This is one of the biggest selling EPs of all time. It went platinum. It's not very often an EP, which is, if you don't know, I imagine if you're listening to this show, you probably know. But for those of you who might not, if your kids are listening, I'll explain it to them. It's half an album. So you have singles, you know, we'll have 2-3 songs. Then you have an EP, which will have about a half an album's worth. And then you got full-length albums. So this was an EP. And it was released to the unsuspecting public. And the first single he gave the record company was Happiness and Slavery. And the video made for it was like this sci-fi nightmare snuff film. And MTV's like, nah, we're going to pass on this. So it got no radio play, and MTV wouldn't play the video. But they released a second single for this song called Wish. And the video was amazing. It's like a live performance, but the band's playing in this cage, and there's people pounding on the cage and yelling at them. And it just was this intense video, and it was a surprise hit. It was actually a hit. It won a Grammy. People forget that.
Really?
The song Wish won Best New Best Metal Performance. A stupid Grammy. I mean, and this is the same institution that gave Jethro Tull Best Heavy Metal Album 1 year over Metallica in like 1989. So for what the Grammys are worth, they give him a Grammy. And, you know, I can't even say some of the lyrics from that song, but one of the lines was fist cuss. And you can imagine what the word actually is. And Trent Reznor at the time was joking in an interview and said he wanted that written on his tombstone. I wrote fist cuss and won a Grammy. But it's true. This this little EP was the little EP that could, and it burst onto the scene and it started making money. And then eventually in the same studio, and keep in mind, this was recorded in the house where, so let me go back a little bit. So the house at 150 CeeLo Drive was purchased by Trent Reznor, and he recorded Broken and The Downward Spiral there. This is the house where Sharon Tate, Roman Polanski's wife, who was pregnant with his child at that time, her and her friends were brutally murdered by the Manson family there. That house is where Nine Inch Nails' The Downward Spiral was recorded. Weird bit of history. And apparently the house was a bit haunted. There are all these tales where they were recording The Downward Spiral of the power just going off for no reason. At one point they were recording and they looked out the window and there was a wolf staring at them. So some frightening things and some dark and scary times. But to me, The Downward Spiral almost single-handedly legitimized the whole industrial thing. Like the whole industrial movement, you can never dismiss it because The Downward Spiral came out of it. And The Downward Spiral sits on the wall next to the White Album, you know, Wish You Were Here, all the great classic albums across the decades. The Downward Spiral sits with its head held high. It is no lesser than any of those classic albums. It's the point where even the most jaded critic would have to look and say, okay, this is art. This industrial music is important. It is relevant. And it's unbelievable the amount of success he had considering how dark these releases were. Unbelievably dark. So we're going to hit the ground running tonight. I'm not going to start you off with a ballad. This is probably going to be the heaviest episode of Chasing Sound ever, except for maybe our one black metal episode. But this is, you know, if you're turned off by heavy music, turn the volume down a little bit. But I want you to listen because this was an important movement and informed a lot of young people at the time. For a lot of young people, this was their thing. It's what they were into. And there are some really good releases. Even if this style isn't necessarily your cup of tea, I'm going to play you the tracks from the bands that absolutely cannot be denied from this movement. So kicking it off tonight, we got Happiness and Slavery by Nine Inch Nails off the 1992 EP entitled Broken.
Sing deep into some Comes from Cornucopia Popcorn, featuring spring flavors, honey lavender, blueberry granola, and white chocolate lemon pound cake. Company logos can be added to Cornucopia Popcorn tins or bags for inspired client gifts. Delivery in Austin and nationwide shipping available by visiting cornucopiapopcorn.com.
Welcome back from that brutal assault, followed by an important message. So we had Burning Inside by Ministry. I want to talk a little bit about Ministry, if I may be so bold. So, much like Nine Inch Nails, you sort of have one main pilot. Most great industrial acts. And by the way, thank you. If you're just joining us, this is Chasing Sound. Tonight and tonight only, we are dedicating our hour to the brief but meaningful musical movement known as industrial music. Let's say 87 through 97. That's what we're going to focus on. Top of the hour, we had Nine Inch Nails, Happiness and Slavery. Was meant to be the lead single for that EP that went on to sell a million plus copies, but the single kind of fell flat because radio and MTV would not play it. Probably Trent Reznor's fault, though. If you've ever seen the video, you almost feel like you could get in trouble with the FBI for watching that video. That's how horrifying it was. After that, though, we had the Reigning Kings, really the band that kind of started it all, Ministry. If you've listened to their first couple of albums, it's much closer to Skinny Puppy, way more synth pop. It wasn't until you started getting into the later 80s that things got heavy and things got kind of political and, to me, infinitely more interesting. So the album that I picked a track from was called A Mind is a Terrible Thing to Taste, probably to this day my favorite Ministry record. Came out in 1989 on Sire Records. And when Jurgensen and the band recall the album, it's not the happiest of memories. Jurgensen says the band state at the time was dysfunctional and the production was complete chaos and mayhem, which gave the band this insane level of artistic freedom. And it, you know, when they look back on it, it just feels like a dysfunctional family falling apart, everybody in different rooms in the studio working on different things, and they all felt like they had a poor relationship. So the band doesn't look back on it very fondly, but like a lot of situations like that, Rolling Stones' Exile on Main Street, the Beatles' White Album, where the band is sort of splintering apart, what comes out the other end ends up becoming a fan favorite and a very important record, and this is no exception to that. At one point, Jurgensen, they said he got drunk and started chasing the bass player around the room with a chair and ended up hitting him on the head, screaming, "I can't stand you anymore." You know, and not the first time that's happened to a bass player. Jay Mascis of Dinosaur Jr. at one point took his guitar off at a show, a Dinosaur Jr. show, and tried to kill Lou Barlow with it. And they what ensued, this is a great moment in rock and roll history. This is right before Lou Barlow was out of the band. Lou Barlow, to defend himself, unsheathed his bass from his shoulders, and they had a sword fight.
That's awesome.
But not like a, hey, it's a festival, let's have a good time sword fight. No, like, I'm defending myself to the death as this guy tries to kill me. So it was just one of those moments. It was magic. The music was insane. They would just record riffs and then go back and use samplers and other things to just turn those riffs out and make them insane sounding, and the album is phenomenal. You think of The Mind is a Terrible Thing to Taste. You know, you had the song Thieves, Burning Inside. The first Ministry I ever got was a live EP called In Case You Decided Not to Show Up, which has this great cover of someone plowing through a windshield like mid-wreck. And it was a live album from this tour, from the A Mind is a Terrible Thing to Taste tour. And me and my friends, we were like in seventh or eighth grade, and we put my friend's stereo speakers into his window and went out on his front yard and we practiced moshing. This is right around the time that moshing really kind of took over the live music happenings. And there we were, you know, probably 13 years old, and we just moshed each other on the front lawn for like an hour. And nobody ever called the police. Those were happier, simpler times. So now I want to get into a band called KMFDM. And more than talking about KMFDM, I want to talk about the first time I saw them, or not the first time, maybe the second or third time I saw them, and the opening act they brought. So in 1997, 97, 98, I was living in Austin, and I was the world's biggest Spoon fan. There's nothing that could keep me from seeing every show that Spoon played. And you got to keep in mind, they were playing a couple times a week. Unless they were on tour, you could catch them pretty regularly, not a couple times a week, three or four times a month, I should say. And I would go to any show they had, Tuesday night, whatever. You could not stop me. I would quit my stupid job. Whatever got in the way, I would just get like, you're not my friend anymore. I'm going to see Spoon. Like, nothing could stop me. And my friend and roommate at the time, Stefan, shout out to Stefan, he bought us tickets without asking me for KMFDM. And he's like, we are going to this. We had seen them a couple times in Houston when we grew up in Beaumont, and we knew they brought the show. They were a band to be reckoned with live. And it was happening on a night that Spoon was playing, and I got so mad at him. In hindsight, it's so dumb. And he was like, you've seen Spoon like 100 times. And I was like, yeah, but So he was like, no, we're going to this. I bought the tickets. It's my treat. We're going to this thing. So we go, and KMFDM were great. I've seen better performances by them. They were good. What was interesting was their opening act, a band at that time who didn't have an album out, no one had heard of, and they came on and stole the show. Of all the bands I'm going to play you tonight, this band I'm about to talk about is a better live show than any of them, and these bands are killer live shows. It's a little band called Rammstein. I'm not going to play one of their songs because, honestly, I went back and listened to their first record. I'm like, it's not even that great. But live, they were untouchable. So we're standing there waiting for this opening act that no one can pronounce the name. No one knows who they are. And the lights go down, and then we see this red laser beam glow like the Terminator's eye in the first Terminator. And this dude comes out wearing all chainmail with a Terminator cyborg eye thing on, and he's on fire.
Oh, wow.
He is on fire and remained on fire for half of the opening song. We were like, when are you going to put him out? Like, why is he still on fire? And they came on stage. And of course, at that time, you know, the song they opened with was Du Hast. And that was a single at the time, Du Hast Mick. And they hit the stage and it was insanity. They had this keyboard player who was just like this daddy long legs looking dude. And at one point, this dude had an inflatable raft, which he put on the crowd. This was at Liberty Lunch, by the way, a long, long ago Austin venue, one of the best roadshow places in Austin. And he got into this raft and took the pose like Washington crossing the Delaware and had the crowd pass him back and forth and maintained this stoic Washington crossing the Delaware pose for the entire ride to the back in front of the club. They squirted the crowd with some weird liquids. There was intermittent fire in a facility that was not built for pyrotechnics. These guys played like they were playing Madison Square Garden, and no one had heard of them. Like, there wasn't even an album for us to buy to have, you know, given the time to get to know them. They were so new, and they just stole our hearts. And they have to be the only band in history that could make a KMFDM show seem a little bit boring by comparison, but they were just that phenomenal. Unbelievable. I still think about that show to this day. I never go back and listen to their music. I bought their first album as a thank you for that live show, but I never go back and listen to it. It was passable stuff, but musically, they don't belong in the list of heavy hitters I have for tonight. So just wanted to share that tidbit for you. The dude was on fire for several minutes. I will never get over that. And where did he get That's the crazy. Cyborg eye? This was the late 90s. Nobody had a huge budget for this stuff. I don't know if one of the guys in that band has a millionaire uncle that gave them money, but they had so much cool stuff and they had to get it through customs. Oh my God. I don't even know, but they were fantastic. So the album that KMFDM was touring at that time is a no-namer. It's got some weird pictures on it. Most of the fans just refer to it as Symbols. It's like, you know, Zeppelin 3 or whatever. It's one, they made some albums where there is no name, so fans just sort of name it after the fact. But this is a single they released off that album called Megalomaniac, and it's a toe-tapper, man. It's in one song, it sort of sums up how much of a good time KMFDM was. They were the party band. Out of all these other bands, they weren't pushing politics. They were pushing party. These guys were German partiers, drinking raw liquor, taking God only knows what kind of drugs, stuff we can't even get in America probably. And they were just fun. They're to the last drop. They were a band that was out to party and steal your soul. So here we go. A little tune called Megalomaniac.
Die Wunder dieser Welt werden dir geschenkt. Glück ist nicht käuflich. Sehnsucht bleibt unerreicht. Preisrätsel winken. Nimmer satt. Kein Mitleid für die Mehrheit. We'll be right back.
left behind. Once I could see, now I am blind. Don't want the dreams you try to sell. This disease I give to myself.
International Women's Day, March 8th, is a global day celebrating the social, economic, cultural, and political achievements of women. Here at Co-op, we celebrate women all year long through the powerful voices of women at Co-op. Although the world has experienced significant changes, there is still so much more work to do. And each year, the world inspires and celebrates their achievements. So join us on Co-op as we celebrate International Women's Day.
Did you claim one of the thank you gifts during Co-op Spring Membership Drive? Please join us from 5 to 7 p.m. Sunday, March 24th at Breakaway Records, 211 West North Loop, for a pickup party. Get your t-shirt and koozies. Then enjoy some refreshments while meeting and greeting some of your favorite Co-op DJs. Hope to see you there.
That's right. Save us a stamp. Pick up your shirt. Come and meet us. We will wash our hands for just that one day. Every other day, probably not.
And you can shake those hands.
You can meet and probably hug or possibly even touch the face of several of your favorite co-op DJs. There'll be koozies. Did you mentioned the koozies, right?
I definitely mentioned the koozies.
I feel like the koozies is what makes it. So thanks for hanging out with us. You're listening to Chasing Sound. This is our special episode devoted to the brief but meaningful movement called industrial music. You're tuning us in live on the internet right now at koop.org. Don't be afraid to visit that website. There's more than just the live streaming feed on there. There's a schedule and all kinds of fun events and a place to donate some money if you want to help out this non-profit little organization that could. You might also be listening to us on your HD device. We can be picked up on the HD3 signal, KVRX HD3. We're rebroadcast on Radio Free America, where you can always find the last two episodes of your favorite shows. Thanks, everybody, for hanging out. Right before the break there, we had the mighty, incomparable Pigface from their first full-length album. There's a song called Suck, and you may have recognized the vocalist there. That's right. Trent Reznor was sort of an honorary member of that group for the first album. He did lead vocals and some co-writing on a couple of tracks on that record, and it is good stuff. You may have also recognized that song as a bonus track from the Broken EP. It was one of those weird things where the first, you know, few thousand copies came with a bonus mini CD. Those aren't really popular anymore, but when CDs were first sort of coming out and the market was getting infused with them, sometimes you could buy a CD single where the CD was the size of like a drink coaster. It was small, like half size. Did you ever see one of those?
No, I don't.
They were really silly and fun, just little bitty CDs. And you put it in your CD player and you're like, is it going to eat it? It's like, you don't know what's going to happen because it's so tiny. But CD players apparently can play CDs of different sizes. It doesn't confuse the CD player at all. After the first few thousand copies, they switched to putting it as a bonus track. So when you got to the end of the Broken EP, it was track 6. If you just let it play, it would go through like 40 or 50 empty 1 second long tracks, and then eventually you would get to like tracks 89 and 90, which were two bonus tracks, and they were both covers, one of course being the Pigface song Suck. A very different version ended up on Broken, but that's the one from the classic album. Before that, we had Megalomaniac by the mighty KMFDM, probably the most party-centric of all the industrial bands. So we're going to move right along here and see how far into this list we can go. I kept the playlist for tonight kind of short because I didn't want to run out of time. But the next thing we're going to get into is this band Prong, and I want to talk about them for a minute. So Prong initially put out an album and had been billed as the next great, interesting metal band, sort of like when Pantera got signed to a big label and put out Cowboys from Hell. It was sort of like, oh, this is the new metal band to be reckoned with. I remember even hearing a story about them in a magazine. Kirk Hammett from Metallica had been sniffing out this band and going to a lot of their club dates, and he went up to their merch booth afterwards and asked for one of their demo tapes, and the guy gave it to him, and Kirk Hammett starts to walk away, and the guy's like, hey man, that's $5. No exceptions. And Kirk Hammett said he really liked that, how they weren't going to let him just have a copy, even though it might have ended up with them opening for Metallica. The guy was still like, we need that $5 tonight, man. We need gas money. And they were interesting. I have to say, in one of the smartest moves I've ever seen with a young band, they put out an album. They were getting some rotation on Headbangers Ball. They were opening for some big metal band names. And then they sort of saw that the wave of metal that was popular at the time, commercially viable, was that wave was starting to break a little bit and roll back. And stylistically, it wasn't as evolving as fast, and it wasn't as interesting. So Prong just stopped on a dime and said, this new industrial thing that's really catching on, we can do that. We could do that probably better than most people can. So their second full-length album called Cleansing, they just stopped being a metal band and became one of the most brutal industrial bands. They took to it like a duck to water, using samplers and all the latest technology, and they made this incredible album, and they released a single. I'm going to play the lead single off that record called Snap Your Fingers, Snap Your Neck, and it is so heavy and powerful, and to this day, it really holds up. I hadn't listened to it in years, and then when putting this show together, I listened to it. I was like, man, this is a great song, and this is a great album by a killer band that time has just about forgot. So strap into your seats. This is Snap Your Fingers, Snap Your Neck by Prong. We'll be right back. When was that?
That was a really good song.
Yeah, that album Cleansing, I highly recommend it. If you're into that sort of thing, and I do realize, judging by the amount of you that are listening, that this is not everybody's thing. Industrial, it's a very specific pocket of music, and if you aren't a big fan of it, probably you might have only been familiar with Nine Inch Nails. They were sort of the band that people outside of the genre really flocked to. More hardcore people were into things like KMFDM and Ministry. Though Ministry did break out a little bit with the, the Psalm 69 album that had a couple of hits, one of which featured our own local homegrown boy, Gibby Haynes from the Butthole Surfers. He did the lead vocal on Jesus Built My Hot Rod, which just to me, that proves how interesting the 1990s were. Jesus Built My Hot Rod had regular rotation on MTV. Just unbelievable, the stuff that, I hate to boast about a certain decade, but to me, I don't think if I had my pick of decades to be growing up in, I don't know if you could beat the 1990s for just how weird everything was, where MTV would play Paula Abdul and then Man in the Box by Alice in Chains, which had this Christ figure with his eyes sewn shut. Just things were so weird, and it all seemed to be happening so fast. It was industrial music, the grunge stuff out of Seattle, just so many interesting things happening, and this really big changing of the guards as, the you know, the stuff from the 80s, the hair, I would hate to say hair metal, but the sort of glam, you know, makeup and long hair, hard rock stuff, the power ballads, as it was fading out, you had all this other stuff coming up, these hungry young artists that were looking to make their mark. And, you know, I know it annoyed a lot of people. There were people a little bit older than me, maybe half a generation older than me, that I hung out with. They really thought that the whole 90s thing was too sullen and too dark, and that the whole, you know, angstiness and the flannel shirts and stuff, they just weren't feeling it. But to me, I like it all. I like the stuff that came before, the stuff that came after it. Every decade has got its gems and albums that are worth looking into. So if you've never dipped your toe into the water of industrial, I hope at least one or two of these songs inspired you. I stand behind every artist that we're playing tonight. They're all worth your time. We're going to leave you off on a gentle note, just in case the show is a little too heavy for your taste. I'm going to play you one of the most mellow Nine Inch Nails tracks ever. This was the one instrumental that was featured on the Downward Spiral. There are way more important songs in the Downward Spiral, and I wish I could have played one of them for you, but I realized as I was listening to that album again for the first time in a few years, just about every track has some swearing in it. And I don't like censoring artists. You know, there's things you can do to bleep out curse words using DAW, like audio software, but I didn't really want to do that. So I picked the instrumental track, and it's an interesting one. It fits well on the album because it kind of gives you a breather from the emotional anguish and the musical tornado that is the Downward Spiral. So this is a track called A Warm Place, and it's going to be our sign-off track. Don't forget to listen to A Stop Clock Friday night at 8 o'clock. Sci-fi short stories read with backdrop music, usually keyboard, sometimes live music, but it's great. One of my favorite co-op shows. And what's the story you're going to do again for this week?
Tideline.
Yeah. That.
It takes place in a post-apocalyptic South Dakota.
Absolutely, where the apocalypse is bound to start in South Dakota. So, yeah, this is going to be our goodnight song. Thank you for listening to Chasing Sound. We're here every Monday at 8 o'clock in the p.m., and we will see you next week. This is A Warm Place by Nine Inch Nails.